the first speaker. Brooklyn from the Eastern area, Eastern Empire area.
Let me put my little timer on here. I know I got backup in the audience, but I don't want to, like, you know, share a mess till the last 5 minutes. So you know how that goes. I do. Hi, everybody. My name is Brooklyn. I'm an addict. So thanks, San Fernando Valley, for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope. Some of you might notice there was a gal named Jessica that who was supposed to be sharing, and for some reason she wasn't able to make it. Wouldn't take a rocket scientist to guess maybe why not. With all the COVID and stuff going on, a lot of people are quarantining. I personally have a lot of antibodies now, so I'm able to go out. Yeah, so where it all began. Great place to start, right here, San Fernando Valley. This is the second time I've been to this convention. I was here maybe 8 years ago, so it's not really one that I come to a lot, but I had some friends that I wanted to support, and that's what we do in recovery. We support our friends, so I thought I'd come out. And another reason I came out is because my life is turning to shit all of a sudden, you know, and when your life turns to shit, what do? You go to NA. Yeah. So, the topic, why do I stay? I've thought about that a lot lately, you know, especially because I'm coming up on some clean time. My clean date's February 17th, 2005. So I'm in a, thank you. I'm in a 30-day countdown or something like that to 17 years clean. And, you know, it's really by the grace of God that I've got this clean time. You know, I think about We Do Recover and how it talks about when at the end of the road, and that's kind of what this convention is all about right now. When at the end of the road, you know, what is there left to do? Either find a new way to live or just, you know, keep going down that grim road into the despair of addiction. And for me, you know, the end of my road was despairing. It was like horrible, you know, it was so lonely, full of isolation, you know, this sick little freaking garage that I'd lived in for over 2 years in the boyfriend's parents' house with the orange cable cords coming through the main house, you know, and trying to make that look all right for many years. I talk about living in two garages and pitching a 10 by 10 tent with my, you know, 7-year-old child in somebody's carport. That's how I lived, you know. It's not fun to live under a tree or not have a home to call your own, you know, and having to leech and depend. And our book very early on talks about the leech, you know, how we have to do things and leech off of people to survive. And I had to do that a lot. I think about, you know, my childhood, and our kickoff speakers were talking a little bit about generational addiction and learned behaviors and stuff. And I could really relate to the family disease because when I think about the generations of like addiction in my own family and, you know, crazy behaviors, I had a great grandmother that was a prostitute. Her sister was a prostitute, and the madam adopted my grandmother because my grandmother at that time couldn't take care of the children that she had. And so the madam takes over my grandmother and doesn't take the other few kids, but that biological grandma ended up at Western States with Francis Farmer for like 15 years in a mental ward. Way back in the, you know, my grandma was born in 1919, so back in the Depression and back when it was very common for women to wind up in asylums and stuff, and they did like electric shock treatment on my little grandma and all kinds of stuff, and she was really never the same. But that little auntie would never admit that she was a prostitute. My grandma was raised in this kind of environment where like she would either be left in cars in downtown Seattle, and people would go down underground. They had these opium dens and stuff like that, and they'd just leave my little grandma in the car waiting for them to come back out of the opium dens and stuff. And my great-grandmother was also a bootlegger, so there was always, like, you know, stuff happening. My grandmother never talked a lot about her abuse, but I know that she was never told that she was loved. And my mother knew that about her mother, and my mother made it a mission to make sure that her mother was always loved. So there was this, like, sick codependence there. And then my mom became very, very controlling, because maybe my grandmother had some issues. And so when I think about generational, you know, addiction and how the dysfunctional family and stuff happens in my life, I see my mother is very authoritarian, very, very strict, and it was her way or the highway. And my dad was kind of like very lax and very like your friend until you did something wrong, and then he would be that really harsh parent that kind of like embarrassed you and stuff like that. I had that kind of an upbringing. And my mom would tell you, she'll swear to God, that I was antisocial. Well, I never thought I was antisocial. I was a very incorrigible child because I was so sick of her like bossing me around and making me do it her way and stuff like that. And so then I would start manipulating very early on and work my dad. And it was all good and fine until like something went wrong, and then my dad would lose his shit for letting me do something, right? But I was very social out in school and stuff. I was so social in school that I forgot to do schoolwork, right? And nobody really noticed that I was struggling in school very early on. And so when you struggle in school as a child, what do? You just kind of clown around, right? So that was happening to me too. And like, this takes a lot of unpacking, and we talk about the onion peel and layers that we have to like get through in our step work, right? And so I'm telling you what, this is a lifelong way of life. Like, you're always kind of looking at yourself, you're always unpacking. You know, people talk about the four step and how horrible it is. Oh, I'm so scared to do the four step. Well, newcomers, guess what? It's already written. Not a big deal. You already did that shit. Just write it down on paper, and you're going to share that with your sponsor. Your sponsor is going to help you figure out some things about yourself, and then you're going to start working on character defects and shortcomings. Those are the hard steps, right? It's not the fourth step. It's the stuff that you're really not aware of, right? Everybody else is aware of in your life. Like my mother telling me that I'm, you know, was antisocial and stuff. Well, antisocial with you, you know, but maybe she does know a little something. I don't know. I feel like addiction, you know, we talk about the chronic and progressive nature of addiction. In my 17 years, almost 16 and some change, you know, I have seen this thing wreak havoc in my life, you know. It's just constantly going. It's just something that I constantly have to manage. And that is one of the reasons I stay. You know, and I am so fortunate. I had such a miserable existence before I got to Narcotics Anonymous. I remember my first meeting. I came in, I'm from the Riverside area, and Jerry with a G, and probably people here know Jerry with a G. He was pretty like out there, like lots of service work in our community, and he had died. And apparently there was like this stand-up memorial for Jerry with a G. And I remember being at the Challen meeting. It was an outdoor meeting, first meeting. And I was rocking in the grass, and I was listening to all you guys talk about this guy and how his funeral was packed out. Like, there was no place for anybody to even sit down. All the chairs were taken, and it was just like this. I just envisioned this just packed house, you know? And I realized at that moment, oh, my God, if I died right now, like, what would my mother think? Like, where's all Brooklyn's friends? Like, there was nobody. You know, and that really, really scared me. And I remember that being just such a profound moment for me. It was a very painful moment for me. And I didn't want that to happen to me. But I could see that that's the road that I was taking. You know, it was really scary. And I didn't come to Narcotics Anonymous on my own. You know, I'm a treatment flunky. People talk about like rehabs all the time and how, you know, rehab got him here. I caught the message from rehab, but I had a terrible experience coming into recovery. I had psychosis. You know, I was one of these people who, like, you didn't even want to get high with. You know, I was really, really scary, and I got psychotic and paranoid and delusional and very, very afraid. And there was a moment, the first time I'm meeting, well, really the second time I'm meeting Narcotics Anonymous, the first time I met was through my brother-in-law, who I was having a psychotic event, and he knew to take me to a meeting. And he's the only one that I could trust at that time because he was close in my family. I was so scared of everybody else. He's like, come on, you know, and he took me to the meeting in Costa Mesa. And I was too lit to even hear the message. I really thought that people even in those meetings were out, you know, watching me or whatever. You know, you have this all important, like it's all about me, right? And nobody's really paying attention to you, but you think they are. And I never stuck with that. I kept using. And then a few years later, I had another psychotic break. I've got my son chasing me down the street. I'm just telling you a little bit how I was, you know. I have my kid, he's like 9, chasing me down the street, and he's yelling, Mom, Mom, you're gray. You're gray, Mom. I'm afraid you're going to die. And my kid knew that I was getting high at that time, you know, and he was struggling trying to parent me at 9 years old, you know. And I just said, come on, we got to get out of here. And we're running down the street, and I think people are chasing me, but there's really nobody there. And I locked myself in the closet, and I grabbed the phone. We still had the phone on the cord. Pulled the cord and the line into this big walk-in closet, and I just thought I was something else, and I called my mom. The thing about calling my mom at that time, I'd called her too many times. So she didn't take me seriously. She didn't realize that her daughter was in such a bad state. So I made my second call, and I called my grandmother, and she lived in Huntington Beach. And my grandmother always heard me. She was like my best friend. And she's the one, she came out for me. And it took her about an hour, and I sat in that closet. And then when I knew my grandma was there, I grandly opened the closet door, and I stepped out, and my grandma comes and gets me, and my family has a hold of me. My mom comes from LA, we're all in Huntington Beach, and we're trying to figure out what to do with Brooklyn. And I remember a time where my mom had said to the doctor, am I ever gonna get my daughter back? You know, right in front of me. And the thing about psychosis, if you're going to compare, you know, you get the alcohol blackout, it's kind of convenient because you don't remember shit. But with psychosis, unfortunately, I remember all that stuff. You know, I didn't black out. Like, I remember what I was thinking and what was going on and all that stuff at the time it was happening, and still to this day. And so they decided to take me to a sober living house, and I had a little one bag thing, because I pretty much left with the clothes on my back, had a little backpack thing to go to this place. And my family dropped me off there. They didn't really know. They said, you're gonna be fine. And it got all twisted there. The manager didn't recognize me. And it started to unravel really quickly. She thought that I was not mentally okay, and her idea for me was to call the police. And like, I did not want the police to be called on me, you know. I was really, really scared, and I was like backing away from her, and I didn't know where I was. My family had just dropped me off there, and this H&I girl from Narcotics Anonymous came in, and she said to the manager, oh no, this girl's just high, man. She's spun. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just spun. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm like, don't call the police. You know, and I'm literally like backing out because this lady is scaring me, you know? And that NA chick happened to know me. She knew exactly what I was going through and what was happening. She said, oh no, you know what? Let me take her. I'm gonna go ahead and take her to detox, Stanton, Westminster. And I said, oh, detox? Okay. She said, come on, honey, I'm gonna take you to somewhere safe. Don't you even worry. I'm like, okay. She was a better alternative than the place my family had dropped me off. So I got into the car with this stranger, and I was still terrified. And this woman brings me to the liquor store, and she says, now I need you to drink this. Drink a bunch of alcohol, because I can't get you into this detox unless you're an alcoholic. And so I'm like, okay. She says, I need you to go into this detox. I need you to tell them you're an alcoholic. That's how you're going to get into detox. If you're just a meth user, just using meth, you're not going to get into detox. I'm like, okay, gonk, 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 gonk. I drink down the alcohol. I smell like alcohol now, and I go into Stanton detox, right? Well, of course, they accept me, and I'm a hot mess. And what was so cool about it at that time is that girl visited me every day, practically, that she could visit me. That girl didn't even know me, and I looked at her one day across from the table, and I was starting to get better, and I was starting to clear, and I said, "Why do you keep coming here to see me? You don't even know me." She said, "Because I care about you. You are me, and I want to see you get better." And I was just like, oh my God. And I just remember her, you know? And so they tried to get me into inpatient. I chose not to go. I had a fiance. I married the drug dealer down the street, four doors down. He didn't want me to go, so we got married. And that was a whole toxic relationship itself there. What a mess that was, you know? And there's just been so many toxic messes in my life, you know? I'm thinking about the codependence of this disease, the codependence, right? Like, I have never been alone. Are there people here who have never been alone? I mean, like, I know there's some people who have never been alone. They pride themselves on, well, I could be alone. You know, I don't need people, you know. But I have never been the kind of person who wanted to be alone. And, I mean, like, I've worked through codependency issues. I'm not like, oh, all I do for you anymore. You know what I mean? I'm more of a team player, but I don't like being alone. And I have settled for, like, so many frogs in order to make sure that I'm not alone. It's like crazy, you know what I mean? I have kissed a lot of frogs. And so I'm like, that's how I got into NA. So I divorced the drug dealer, and then I have like nowhere to go again. We had relapsed, of course. I mean, an addict can do 6 months standing on their heads. If you think you got a problem, you'll go dry for 6 months just to prove to your loved ones that you don't have a problem, you know? And so I did that for a while, but then I relapsed, and I got caught up with this other dude. That's where I end up in the garage in his parents' backyard, and we start moving and shaking at the Rubidoux swap meet. That's right. That was my living because I was no longer employable. I'd lost all the good jobs. You know, my jobs just seemed to scale down every single time. You know, when I was in my 20s, I was soaring, but in my 30s, I was like collapsing. And I became unemployable because I was just so high all the time, like you couldn't even take me anywhere. So Rubidoux swap meet was my best bet because I had to make some money to get more dope. So there I am at the Rubidoux swap meet, and I have another experience with Narcotics Anonymous. This guy named Eric from West Side Empire, shows up at the swap meet. Eric is a garbage collector by trade, but he also does swap meeting too. And he sees me and my boyfriend at the time. Now, I'm just like this. I can't even, like, look out into the world at all. I'm just like, you know, moving things around and making my display right. Like, I can't even like talk to people, you know? And it was very, very obvious that I was just like out there. My boyfriend's talking to this guy and he leaves my boyfriend. He says, you know, I feel like I know you guys, you know, I want to just leave this directory for you. If you ever need help, give me a call. And Eric put his number on the front of that directory and he gave us that directory. I lost that directory in that filthy garage for like a year. And so one day, my boyfriend, who's going on his fourth term at Chino State, and he's not listening to me anymore, and he's not coming home to me anymore, and he's cheating on me with the ratchet women in the hood, right? And bringing back all kinds of fun things. You could go to Planned Parenthood and look at the little wall, see what he's bringing back to me, swearing to God that it's all my fault, right? You ever go to Planned Parenthood and look at the wall and go, uh-oh, doot, doot, doot. Well, at least I don't have that one. That was me. So I've got a boyfriend who doesn't give a shit about me. I'm living in a garage. I'm suffering from psychosis. I can't work. I'm depending on his parents. And my life is miserable. And he doesn't come home anymore. I couldn't go out to get my dope. I couldn't fend for myself because I was too paranoid to go out. He always brought me the dope. So I was at his mercy. If he didn't show up with the dope, I was just screwed. And so I asked him to come home, and he wouldn't come home, and he was ignoring my calls. You know how we do, you know. He's busy. And I wasn't a priority anymore, and I was coming down. And so I went on that, you know, that cleaning spree that we do. Me and the vacuum cleaner in the garage and cleaning everything, you know, and just trying to be busy. And I found that directory from Eric. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to a meeting. Because I remembered from, you know, all these years prior that, like, anywhere you go, they tell you to go to a meeting. And so I picked up the directory and I wound up at that challenge meeting, rocking in the grass. And those people saw me. I left before the prayer. I couldn't go prayer to prayer. I couldn't talk to people, but I'd just sit there and rock in the grass by myself and listen. And I kept coming to the meetings. I kept coming to the meetings. And eventually somebody saw me and said, hey, as I was leaving at the break, because when you take a 10-minute break, you have to talk to people. So at the 10-minute break, I would just go to the parking lot and get in the car and go. And somebody started seeing my MO, because when you go to meetings a lot, you start seeing the same people, so they start watching you. And you guys were watching me. And so you caught me at the break, and you said, hey. She said, come here. What's your name? And she started talking to me. She said, you want a cigarette? I said, sure. And we started smoking at that smoking break, and she got me through the break. And she said, come on, come sit by me. And she grabbed me by the hand, and she brought me to the seat next to her. I don't know whose it was, but there were other people standing on the wall. She didn't care whose seat it was mine that day. You know, that girl isn't in the meetings anymore, but I am. And I've seen a lot of people like leave Narcotics Anonymous, and I am so grateful that I stay, because the reality of the life of an addict is so grim. And I just hear that word, you know. Grim is to me like deadly, like it's a horrible, horrible life. And if you've lived the life that we have lived, a lot of you know what I'm talking about. That's probably why you're in the seat you're in now, because you know the grim reality. And this is the safest place and the most normal I've ever felt, Narcotics Anonymous. When I went to Stanton Detox and they threw the AA book at me, I didn't understand it. I didn't want AA. I wasn't an alcoholic. So I couldn't hear any kind of message there. What I needed is I needed that girl from H&I, Narcotics Anonymous. You know, you go to a lot of rehabs now and they just throw the big book. And nothing against AA. I know it's the granddaddy of all fellowships, but I needed Narcotics Anonymous when I came into treatment. And I'm just so grateful that guy that didn't come back that night that I was doing swap meets with, his parole officer, made him go. And so my codependency come on, you're going to a meeting. You know, and he would go, and then he wouldn't go, and then he'd want me to have his court card signed for him, so I'd go, and I'd sign the court card, get it signed for him, and then one day I looked at him, and I said, I'm not getting your court card signed, you're doing it yourself. You go to your own damn meetings, you know. That guy ended up going back on another term. He did another 18 months. And even while I was in Narcotics Anonymous, I visited him every weekend at Chino State. We did canteen, him and his mom, me and his mom, codependent, good codependents that we are. Every weekend, I got a boyfriend in Narcotics Anonymous. They say don't get into relationships, you know, your first year. I'd like to see who does that. Every now and then you get a couple of people who actually follow that rule. It's not easy. I got hooked up with another guy in NA, and I'll tell you what, that guy kept me coming back. You know, it probably wasn't healthy, and it turned out to be kind of like not good, you know, in the end there, because there's always, when you get involved in relationships like that, there's always somebody who gets hurt. That one, it wasn't me, because I was still using my manipulation and getting my needs met the way I knew how, and I hurt that guy. But when my guy got out of prison, his parents bought the house across the street. The old man had died, literally died, and they bought the house, and me and Ricky moved into the house across the street from his parents, so we upgraded from the garage to the house across the street, but literally the old man died and everything was still in there. So we just took over the guy's house, like his whole furniture, everything. And that was a sick, toxic relationship even after he got out of prison. And one day, I was doing really good in recovery. I'd met a lot of people and I had friends and I was in service. Like my first 90 days, I started service work right away in Narcotics Anonymous. I carried helpline. I'm a big PR, PI person. I did panels for women's jails. I did H&I panels for treatment facilities. Always been in service. And when he got out of prison, I force-fed him Narcotics Anonymous because I was already in, you know. And I didn't make it very attractive for him. I really didn't. And he came into NA and he didn't like my friends. Like, we didn't have the same kind of, like, interests. It was very, very strange. Anyway, I was dragging him around, and I thought, I know the perfect sponsor for him. I'm going to bring him to his new sponsor. And so I went looking for the sponsor, and I'm dragging my high boyfriend. The meeting was dark. They said, it's over at Stacy and Tim's house. Here's the directions. I went over to Stacy and Tim's house, and ring the doorbell, me and high boyfriend. I mean, he's got shit coming out of his nose and everything. It's like, you know, it's just like he's so high, but I'm clean. I'm like, can we do something to help this guy? And so Stacy's brother answers the door. He says, hi, Brooklyn. And I'm like looking up at him and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Love at first sight. He knew my boyfriend. He's like, hey, Ricky, how you doing? You remember me? We went to school together. I'm like, no way, you know. Anyway, Ricky sat through that meeting high. He didn't stay in the meetings. Ricky would go on to have a meth-induced stroke and then die. I would go on to court and chase around Stacy's brother relentlessly. No, I'm serious. I also got a new sponsor. I was actually going to pick Stacy for my sponsor. I chose Carolyn Kay. God rest her soul. Today is her belly button birthday. She died a few years back of small cell lung cancer. I got to bury my sponsor. It was one of the saddest things I've ever been through in my whole life. And also an honor to be able to be that close to that experience. Like, I prayed over her and held her hand as she was fighting to die. And you know what? Life goes on. Life on life's terms isn't very fun. I went on to marry Stacy's brother. I got Carolyn as a sponsor, worked all my steps, and the idea of this fellowship is to pay it forward, and that's what I've been doing since. And so I have several sponsees, probably more than I should. And you know, when I think about step work and tradition work, I really wish that more people did the work, because a lot of times I need help. You know, we need people to step up in this program and sponsor. Sponsorship is like the highest honor, and it's something that's desperately needed. I mean, how many times have you been out there and said, oh, I'm sorry, I can't sponsor you, I haven't worked my steps. But I know who can, you know? I get that call a lot. And I just want to really encourage people to get through those steps, you know. And it's not like you don't have to do it like a race, you know. Honestly, it took me 4 years to get through all my steps. And I'm not alone in that. I hear a lot of people talk about that. My first set of steps took a long time. And you know what? The thing I can say is at least I did them. Because in this 16 years, 11 months, and 4 days that I have today, I've gotten 3 women through the steps. I don't know if that says a lot about me or if it says a lot about them. I'm really not sure. All I know is that I show up and I give the direction. And if the sponsee's ready and willing and it's the right time for them, then they're ready and willing. You know, that's all I can do. But what I do know is that I keep showing up and I keep showing up. And I keep showing up. And when my ass is falling off, I keep showing off. Because don't you know, my ass is falling off. This has been a really tough year. It's been a really hard year for me. I gave up a lot. I gave up a really good job. I cashed out my 401k to go to what I thought was a better job that turned out to be nothing but a totally toxic family. I mean, you could see so clearly that I was in the wrong place. It was like so crazy, you guys. Like, I just got fired on the 13th, which, by the way, was my sponsor Carolyn's death date. And I wasn't even I wasn't even sad about it or like scared about it. I was just really like, there it is. Because I kind of knew it was going that way, you know? Like, I don't know how mighty your God is, but, like, since I've been in this fellowship, I've seen the miracles unfold. Like, there have been such amazing miracles in my life, and it's all a direct result of me doing the steps and even walking through the fear when I'm scared, you know? And I just, like, take the next indicated step. I really, really do. I thought this $6 an hour more raise job was going to be something good for me. How can you like not take a job 10 minutes from your house with $6 an hour more? Of course you're going to take it. You know, I'm going to go for that. Well, it wasn't a bad fit. Turns out like total toxic family. I can tell you each staff member, what role they played, you know, scapegoat, lost child, hero child, comic relief. Oh my God. And mommy and daddy, you know, it was like crazy. But anyway, I mean, it takes a hit to my ego, you know, because, you know, I hear in the readings, acceptable, responsible, productive member of society. And that's all I really want to be. I want to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions, you know, because I live so much of my life being that leech and being dependent on other people for my well-being. I want to be fully self-supporting. So I'm not attached to money because I'm so fortunate. Like, all I have to do is be happy, you know, because I have a really great husband who takes really good care of me, fortunately. You know, the rule in the house is you don't have to have the best job, but you do have to have a job. You know what I mean? So all I got to do is have a job. I can do whatever I want. So that whole productive thing, I don't have to be making the $1 million or anything. But for my own, you know, ego, I guess. It's ego and pride. I want to make good money. Who doesn't? Who doesn't want to take care of themselves, right? I want to be able to take care of myself and not be dependent on my husband. How about that? That's fair to say. And it's really, really a struggle in today's world to be able to do that. You know, partnership is really important. We're such an individualistic society. You know, I know how to take care of myself today if something did happen to my husband. And I have the support with all of you guys too. I know that I'm never alone. I've never been alone since I came into this fellowship. And you know what? I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but I definitely am someone's cup of tea around here. And this is where I get to be me. Like, for the first time in my whole life, I could just be me. You know, either lover or hater, I know who my friends are and I know who my friends aren't. And that is so freeing, just to be me. And I get to do that and I get to practice that. You know, I am so awkward. We talk about the square peg in a round hole all the time. You know, the little NA symbol. Like, that's me. Everywhere I go, I'm like so awkward. Sometimes I say some stupid, weird shit, you know? It's like, see, and I get a courtesy laugh like that. Thank you, Jeff. You know, this program is beautiful and it saved my life. And that's why I stay and I do it the NA way. I'm hardcore NA, you know, I've done a lot of other things too. You know, we talk about outside help. Have you ever gone to like an ANDA? So I've been in these other meetings to help with my other problems and stuff, and I'm sitting in these meetings and the whole time I'm thinking, why am I not in my NA meeting right now? All this has done is separated me again from the people who I need to be with. It's so crazy because this disease is so vicious that the first thing it does is it separates me from people who love me, you know, like my family, my sister, my mother, my father, you know, all the people that are close to me who love me, it separates me from. And then it has a real good way of separating me from my emotions. I don't want to feel anymore because I feel like shit about lying to my family, stealing, cheating, all this sneaky shit I do to feed this disease. It separates me from my emotions. I just got to get higher so I don't have to feel that pain. You know, when I'm high enough, I don't care anymore. And then it separates me from society. Doesn't it separate you? See how it separates you from society? You don't even know how to act anymore. You're just, people don't like being around you anymore. Oh, here comes Brooklyn again. Ooh. You know? You're doing shit where you're getting arrested. You know, the ER's tired of seeing you. The EMTs are tired of seeing you. Your boss is sick of you. Society at large, man, you're just a scourge. You're lying, cheating, stealing from all of society. The ripple effect of that is immense. You know, I don't take into consideration how I'm hurting society, how my cigarette butts out in the parking lot of the Marriott affect people who aren't addicts that are just trying to have a California vacation right now, you know? I really encourage people to consider how you're behaving, because a lot of us have behavioral problems that are very, very self-centered. And part of this loving program is giving back. And it's not just giving back to Narcotics Anonymous, it's giving back to your family. I mean, because a lot of us will come into NA and totally forget our families, be too busy to spend time with your kid on the weekends because there's more fun things to do in NA. Like, we forget about like how to balance our time. And as you grow in recovery, you know, there'll be times where you think to yourself, like, why am I even here? I don't need NA anymore. My head whispers that in my own voice all the time. I've had so many friends go out of Narcotics Anonymous, and I know what happens to people who leave Narcotics Anonymous. That's another reason I stay. I'm still friends with people who are out there trying to make alcohol, you know, manageable, marijuana maintenance, manageable, you know. But every time I just see, you know, I hear the stories, going to the bars, screwing people in their cars, feeling bad the next morning. Start off with just a couple hits of weed to, you know, numb the pain, and now you're doing an ounce a day. It just never ends. It really just never ends. And it's so hard to, like, have that balance in your life, you know? What do they say? Bio, psych, social, spiritual. That's the condition that we're treating. It's like so hard to balance all that, isn't it? I'm like either in on one and totally out of another. I got to keep Narcotics Anonymous to keep me on the level. Always, always. And this gift of recovery is priceless to me. Like, I will never forget where I came from. I will never forget that girl so frightened and full of psychosis and mental illness. I will never forget her. And I will always remember the love that I am shown in the fellowship. And you know, don't get me wrong, like the fellowship is fallible. The fellowship is us. But we're a beautiful, small community of people just trying to stay clean one day at a time. The solution is in the steps, and it's living the traditions. That's where your life gets saved. It really is. You know, I want to thank San Fernando Valley for choosing me by God's grace to come up here and share some experience, strength, and hope today. I hope that you all have a wonderful convention, and thanks for letting me share.
Let's thank Brooklyn again, you guys. All right, you guys, now I'm gonna introduce to you guys the second speaker. From San Fernando Valley, Carlos D.
Okay, thank you. Oh, man. All right, my name is Carlos, and I'm an addict. And thank you, Brooklyn. That was awesome, man. Thank you so much, man, for coming up here. First of all, I'd like to tell you, man, that I was born and raised in the San Fernando Valley, man, and so this is my hometown. So you know, there's a lot of people here that you know are from here that are here right now. Some of my people that my circle of recovery here, man, and some men I sponsor. My wife's here. Some good friends of mine, some friends of mine from Northern California and from back east. And I like to, you know, this ain't the opening meeting and I'm not the welcoming committee, but I'd like to welcome you to San Fernando Valley, man. Yes, it's where it started, and yes, it's still strong as ever. And I'm happy to tell you, and I'm proud to tell you that I'm part of it, you know. And that means a lot to me, you know. When I first they gave me this topic, I'm like, how am I going to tell everybody how, you know, why we stay? I don't know why everybody stays, you know? And, you know, so I started, you know, going on that one, you know, I get off on, you know, analyze, criticize and all that shit, you know? And, you know, I read a little bit and what's funny was this because, you know, sometimes I don't know if I'm getting older or what, but it takes some for me to get reminded of something to go back and look at it, you know? And man, I started thinking, why do I stay? And I was like, man, there was like 100 reasons, right? And I'm going, man, you know, where do I start, you know? I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I don't want to get too deep into it because after I start to tell, you know, I always become Rambo in the end and I don't want to do that shit to you guys, you know? And I was really, as an addict, closer to Dumb and Dumber or, you know, something like that, you know? But, you know, it's just, I was born and raised here. I, you know, grew up with a single mother, father in prison most of my life. And, you know, I went to the streets as a young boy, man. You know, we moved around a lot. There was a lot of ugliness in our lives, man. My mother struggled, you know, she did the best she could. And, you know, so I, I was introduced to streets as a little boy, and that's where I found my, my upbringing. You know, I come from the type of place where if you're 11-year-old and you live on the block, or 10 years old, you hung out with the 25-year-olds. You know, it just whoever lived in that little area hung out, you know. So as a little boy, 11 years old, I had a bag, you know, a bottle, a quart of Olympia, and a cigarette in my mouth and a bandana on my head and, you know, and trying to act like the older guys. And I always like to tell this story because, you know, my mother was well respected in the little neighborhood I lived in, and she was kind of like, she would willing to tell, she didn't give a shit who you were or how many years you had done. If she was pissed off at you, she would tell you, right? So I'd be sitting out there smoking cigarettes with all the older guys, and they'd be with their girlfriend, they'd be playing oldies, and she would come in looking for me because I used to sneak out the window. And she'd come out there, back in the day they wore curlers in their hair, and she'd come out there with a broom and start hitting me in front of all these people. So 2 minutes before that, I was cool, right? Drinking, drunk on about four drinks with a cigarette, just saying everything these guys said, you know, trying to act like I was some kind of little tough guy. 10 minutes later, I was running down the street with my mom at 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night. She hit me with the broom, you know. And that's the story of my life, you know, a fake and a phony, you know. And that's pretty much goes on for a long time, being that fake and a phony, you know. So, yeah, you know, I just grew up, man. I had a mad affectionate relationship with paint. You know, I used to sniff paint like it, like you would have thought I was going to grow up to be a painter, you know. And I would sniff the shit out of that, you know. And today when I look back, when I look at my nephews or, my grandkids, and I'm thinking, you know, I was 11 years old when I was doing this. And I was thinking, at what could be so bad in my life at 11 years old that I felt better? Because if anybody sniffed glue and paint, all you do is you get a buzz. That's it. That's the high. You paint your shoes, your lips are all gold. You know what I mean? Everything you own is gold. And I would rather be this as an 11-year-old kid or 12-year-old kid than to be a kid, just playing, doing what regular kids do. When I see my grandkids today or my nephews, nieces, and I was like, how, you know, and that thought comes, is like, wow, man, what was happening? There was a lot of pain involved, man. My life had gone, there had been a lot of pain in my life, you know? I didn't know it then, but that was my, I know today that, you know, after doing some work, that was a result of me not dealing with it and finding an escape, you know. As a kid, you know, I just always wanted to be somebody else other than myself. You know, as a kid, all I ever wanted to do was be like the other kid down the street, you know, or like one of my cousins, or when I'd go to their home, I'd leave there, and I always just felt like, why, you know, what happened here, man? How did I get dealt this, you know? And until I became that, you know. I became everything I hated, like a lot of us do, you know? And, you know, as I grew up, it just continued and continued. It got worse and worse, and, you know, and I don't want to go into too many of my war stories because, like I said, I always end up ramble at the end, you know? But I just got involved in crime as a little kid. I became a thief. I became, you know, we didn't have money, so I stole. Everybody went shopping for school clothes. I went and stole mine at JCPenney's, you know. And I was good, too, as a young boy. I could steal. And I went to school that first day. I was decked out. All stolen shit, but I was decked out, you know. And, you know, and it was awful, man. It was awful, you know, but it became a way of life. And when it becomes a way of life, it's not that bad. You know, you can find a way to not deal with it, you know. So, you know, it just, you know, it got worse, just like everything else in addiction. It never gets better, you know. My father was in and out of prison, and it started getting older. We started connecting a little bit, you know, because, you know, I was one of those kids. All I ever wanted was a dad, you know, and didn't have one, you know. And so, luckily, I had some uncles. But the sad part was I had some great uncles, you know, some good men, man, hardworking good men. You know, and they were there for me, but for some reason I choose the guys on the street, you know, and they were, you know, out of prison or wherever they were coming from, you know, and most of them were 40, 50 years old and still live with their parents, so, you know, they weren't really on the success path, you know, and so by the time I got to high school, man, I was just drug infested, man. Everything in my life was just drugs, selling them. That's how I made a living. Everything was drug, you know. And they no longer wanted me in any kind of school. They kicked me out of, well, let me tell you how this happened. This is kind of a funny story. It's not funny, but it's true. My father just got out of Folsom Prison, and he had spent, you know, already like 30, 40 years in prison. So everything he thought was prison, you know, he looked at everything as prison. So at that time, they had this Hispanic movement going on, you know, they were going to change the world and all this. So he gets out of prison. I get kicked out of San Fernando High School, where I went. San Fernando? That was San Fernando High School. And they told me, we don't want you no more. Get out of here. That's kicked out of continuation, right? My father just got out of prison. He said, they can't do that. We have rights. This guy just got out, you know? And I'm going to take you in there, and I'm going to demand our rights and blah, 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 right? Well, just so happens, the principal, this guy Joe Crunk, was an ex-police officer. So him and my father get in there. By the time I get out of there, I'm no longer allowed in any city school. And I was like, how did this happen, you know? But that's the story of my life, you know? He's like, ah, man, those guys, they don't understand. Don't worry about it. Well, now I can never go to any school, you know? And that was it, you know? Eventually, I went to jail. My father was in jail. And I got caught up in that, you know, in and out, man. And, you know, we both got released around the same time. And that was a whole different ballgame there. Me and my father became addicts. I mean, we became crime partners. We were addicts. We became crime partners, and we started to do a lot of ugly stuff, man. And, you know, I just remember, man, there was a certain part of me. It's weird how this works, and I don't know if anybody can relate to that. There was a certain part of me where I was so happy to be with my father, finally. I got that father I wanted, but there was a certain sadness about it. Was we were strung out heroin addicts committing major felonies. And I was confused on it, you know. I didn't know that someday that would be my history with my father, you know. That's my story with my father, you know, in jail, locked up, handcuffed, sitting in the back of two different police cars, you know, shooting heroin, fucking selling heroin, you know, just madness, you know. And when I tell people that, you know, it's like they just kind of look, you know, it's like, wow, really? And, you know, and today I could tell you, rather than shoot heroin with my kid, I would rather blow my fucking brains out. And I would hope I would have the balls to do that, you know, because that's disgusting today. But my father was an addict, you know, that's all he knew. He couldn't teach me how to be a good son. He couldn't teach me how to be, he wasn't a doctor. He couldn't teach me how to be a good doctor. He couldn't teach me how to do other things. Teach me how to fucking be a good addict. And he taught me, you know, until, well, I don't know. I don't know how good of an addict you are if you're in jail, you know. And, you know, it was kind of an ugly story because we did it for a while. You know, we ran. But meanwhile, while we're doing this, there's a lady there, my mother, who was on her own, welfare, fighting, working her ass off, taking buses to try to raise my sister. Meanwhile, her heart is broken. Not only is her ex-husband, you know, still in her life, still causing major effect, but now her son's out there, and now she's scared to death, you know? And, you know, that's the ugliness of this disease. This disease is ugly, man. And you know, I'd like to tell you that my father was an addict, so I've been a child of an addict. I was an addict, so I've been the addict. And my son is an addict. So I've seen all three. I call it the trifecta, you know. And I want to thank God for some of those other programs, because some of those other programs they go when your kid's in there, all that, you know, I'm not going to mention the name. You guys figure it out. But where the families go and all that, you know, my wife's very heavily involved in that. And I've got involved in it. And it, at that time, for some reason, I couldn't find the answers here. Maybe I wasn't working a good program. I don't know. But I found them there. And when my son, you know, we watched him, man, and he almost died out there, man, and he got crazy, you know. And me and my wife, we did everything, because we both come from families of addicts, and we did everything to make it good for him. It's Christian school, everything, but he was an addict, and we watched him go through, you know. So I'm all three of those things. By the way, my son's clean today. So 11 years, he just took 11 years. So, you know, I'm the trifecta, man. I got them all. I know how it feels from all ends, you know. So when I come to speak somewhere or something, I get kind of confused sometimes because I feel them from all different parts, you know. So, you know, I end up, you know, through all that shit, you know, I could go through all of it, but it doesn't matter what happened. That's the fine points of my using. What happened was is I end up in jail. I got a pretty heavy case. They give me a joint suspended. But at the end of it, I have to go to a recovery house. Back then, there was only a few. In Southern California, there was probably three or four. Now there's one like Starbucks and McDonald's at every corner, you know? You got 10 grand, baby, you're in, you know? But today, back then, there was a few. They were big ones, and that was it. There was no sober livings, no nothing, you know? That was in 1978. So in 1978, I get released, and the part of the end of it, I have to go to this program. So I go to this one on Burbank Boulevard. For you who's not from here, it's about 8 minutes from here. It was one of the big ones out here, one of the only ones. And man, I don't know what to expect. All I knew was that it was different than anything I had saw. I had never been, I came from a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood, and pretty much on the any other parts, they were all racially cut up. You know, they were usually either your, you know, they were okay, you were okay with them, or they were your enemy, but you didn't really hang too much with them. And so when I go in here, there was people from everywhere, man. People, all kinds of different people, you know? So it was a new thing for me. But the truth of the matter is, and I like to tell people this because just in case you, there's one person out there that if they're new and they understand it. When I walked in there, I was just trying to figure out, I wasn't thinking of staying clean. I was trying to figure out how I wasn't gonna get busted or how I could still use without getting hooked or how I could just figure out a plan that wasn't gonna take me down the same road. But it had nothing to do with staying clean. If I just drank, so I'm sitting in this recovery house and these people are all smiley and they're happy. And you know, that back then they didn't hug. Everybody was still holding hands and you know, times were different, you know. And I started to look around, you know, and I didn't believe these people. I thought this was, you know, I came in the 70s. So I thought this was one of those communes, you know, where everybody gets naked and they walk around and they put, you know, river water. I'm thinking this is going to come, right? This is, because that's why there's a mixture. There's a lot of hippies there. And I thought this is some, you know, and I was like, I'm waiting for this to happen, right? Because I'm thinking I'm going to hit that fence, man. I ain't doing this shit. I saw Woodstock, you know, you know, so I end up starting to meet some people. And these people started to affect me. I started to laugh. And I started to feel a little bit. I wouldn't tell you that. And then I ended up blowing out of there, getting loaded, you know? So then I came back and some of these people showed up for me. They came and they greeted me and were glad you're back. And what happened for me is, you know, some people come in and I say, hey, I looked at the board and I saw the steps and I just, you know, I knew it was me. Or I did this and I knew it was me. I was influenced by the people here. You know, when I walked in 1978 and then back in 1979, I was influenced by the people. You know, they talk about people loving you until you can't love yourself, you know? And back then, Narcotics Anonymous had just started. Jimmy Kay was still alive. Jimmy Kay was here in North Hollywood. And it was different than, you know, I listened to your story. But back then, we only had one way to go. And so we went that way, you know? And I have total respect for them. I don't do them, but I don't have a problem with them, you know? And I totally respect. So at that time, you know, I left and I continued to get loaded. Every time I would get clean, I'd start to get healthy, and then I'd get too smart for myself. This thing would take over and it would say, hey, King Kong shows up again, right? Hey, you did this. Wow, you can see, you just don't have to use. I'd get loaded, end up in the streets again, you know? And in June 27th of 1980, I was in the streets, I was doing those things again, and I just couldn't do it no more. I just couldn't do it, you know? And I believe that God at that day gave me the courage. I was strung out, gave me the courage to pick up the phone and to call this friend of mine, Johnny Martinez. He was one of my mentors. He had a few years here. You gotta remember, when I first came, man, if you had 10 years, you had some of the most time here. If you could have 2 years or 1 year and you could be a main speaker or a circuit speaker, you know, it wasn't happening here. And I remember calling Johnny Martinez up and telling him, Johnny, I'm done, man. I can't do this no more. Johnny, get me into detox. No, you keep calling me, man. You ain't ready. No, I've gotten you in before, you know. And no. And that's when we used the dime at the payphone, right? And I remember I said, Johnny, man, I can't do this, man. I need help. And he said, okay, one more time. I'm going to get you in to this detox. And if you leave, don't ever call me again. And he called me. He says, call me back in 10 minutes. Called him back in 10 minutes. He said, hey, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Be here. Or 8 o'clock. So, of course, I had to go get loaded. You know, so I had to get up at like 4, you know. And I think I stole something. I sold it to the 7-Eleven guy. And yeah, so I don't know what I did. But anyway, he took me. I was there. On the third day, I was there. I was sitting there, and I couldn't do it no more. I knew I couldn't do it. It was over. But I was taking this methadone, and they were giving me these pills. And the methadone, the pills were getting me so low that it was better than the heroin I had been shooting out there. And I said, shit, I could just stay here forever, you know? And I just couldn't do that. Everybody sits and lies, you know? Everybody's a pimp, a player, and a part-time hustler. Everybody has kilos, but yet they're asking you for a cigarette, you know? Oh, yeah, when I get to my house, I got 40 kilos in my garage, and yeah, they'll steal your tennis shoes if you close your eyes, you know? And I just got, I got tired of being one of those phony and fakes again, and I couldn't do it. And I really believe that every time I made a move like that, that God gave me the courage, because I didn't have it. And I remember on June 29th of 1980, they woke us up, you stand in line, you know, all the big killers, gangsters, mean dudes, nobody tells me what to do, stand in line like this and don't say nothing for your methadone, you know, like little puppets, you know? And you take your methadone, take your pills. And I remember I walked up to the counter, and the lady says, here, and they're real rude to you. I mean, come on, we're a bunch of fucking drug addicts. You take your thing, come on, I got a line behind you. And I remember I just stood there, man. And I really believe, man, because I couldn't do that, man. That methadone gets you loaded. I said, nah, man, I don't want it. And she goes, what? Take the, I don't want it. And I'm standing there, and I don't know why I stood there. I just didn't have to get in line. And I said, no, I just had to say it, I don't want it. And the guys behind me and the girls behind me, oh, honey, take it, you know, take it, you know, and spit in my mouth. And, you know, they want a double dose. You take two toes of mustard, you can almost, you know, oh, and some of the guys are, you know, I'll kiss you for it, you know, whatever, you know. And it's like, you know, it was insane, you know. And I remember I walked away, I got on the phone, and I said, Johnny, man, I'm done. No, you told me 10 days, but Johnny, I'm done. You better stay a couple more days. 2 days later, I had somebody pick me up. No, the next day. That was the last day I got loaded. That was June 29, 1980. I had 41 years in June. So, you know. And the reason I mentioned that is for one reason. Because if there's anybody out there that's a relapser, and you're sitting there telling yourself you can't do it, you're lying to yourself. I'm telling you, you can. I'm a relapser. I've done this. I've relapsed a couple times, you know. And today I want to tell you why I'm staying. See, when those people surrounded me, when they surrounded me with the loving care, when they didn't even know me, when my own family didn't want anything to do with me because they were afraid of me, when they surrounded me, there was men like Johnny Martinez, Robert Morales, Vita Morrill, you know, so many people, Eddie Farrell, man, you know, there's a list of them that were there for me, and they're gone today. They all died clean. You know, members of Narcotics Anonymous. They were here when this thing started. But they circled me with those covered wagons, man, and protected me until I could protect myself. And they loved me until I loved myself, you know. And that's one of the reasons I stay, because they promised. They told me, I said, why do you guys do this? They said, because someday you'll do this for somebody else. You know, someday you'll do this for maybe one of our children, one of our grandchildren, you know. And I believe that today. I believe that I don't just, you know, besides, you know, first I thought, and here's the part of that where everything broke into certain parts for me. When I first came, I just stayed here because I didn't have any other plan, right? I had nowhere to go. Nobody wanted me. I burned everybody that I'd been around. So I stayed for that, you know. Later on, I stayed because I got attached to the people, and I started to believe that they believed. And only because they believed in me, I started a taste that maybe I could make this. You know, and it continued on. You know, at first when I came around, I was like you. I didn't work those steps. I didn't do nothing. At those times, you know, we were running wild, man. This was, you know, this was crazy. NA was crazy back in the day. I don't know what you heard, but this shit was crazy, you know? And, you know, and I hung in there, man. I hung in there, you know? And but yet, part of not working the steps, I paid a hell of a price, man, because I continued to rely on things outside of me to make me happy. You know, I continued on, you know, what I wore, you know, jewelry. Back then, everybody wore gold, Mr. T and all that, more jewelry, you know, the car I drove, you know. Everything on the outside of me made me. And it made, it, to me, it made me. To anybody else, it didn't. You know, walking around like an idiot with a bunch of gold, man, that's, you look more like, you know what I mean? And, you know, and so, you know, today I don't really wear anything. I don't wear, I just wear a watch once in a while. You know, I just, they remind me of those days, you know. But, you know, and then that changed. And I started to work on myself. And those things no longer became as important. Do I look a nice house? Yeah, do I look a nice house? I like all that stuff. But it's not who I am. It's not who I am. You know, today, as I started to work on myself, as I started to do these steps, man, as I started to circle myself with people that were doing the thing here, man, is, you know, it's when my life came alive, when that spirit livened up, man. And when that spirit livened up, man, it gave me not just did I get to know myself a little bit better, you know, but I got to be able to carry that message better, you know. I got to the part where I wanted to carry that message, where I loved to carry that message, where I become passionate about carrying the message of Narcotics Anonymous, you know, that you, your son, anybody can make this happen, man, you know. Later on, you know, it's like I started to deal with men, you know, and give the best shot, you know, and tried to carry this message to men, that even some men that I didn't even think were going to make it, but I would take a shot, you know. And you know, later on, my son started to use, and I remember me and my wife were going crazy. We were trying to save him. I thought, hey, I work with all these other men. Why can't I do it for my son? And I told people before, but when it happens in your backyard, everything changes. You know, that's why I crack them up. Hey, you do this, do that. Yeah, idiot. Sure. Let it happen in your backyard. You know, I used to work with kids. I used to work with Tough Love for a short time, you know, and I used to tell parents, hey, you know, do this, kick them out. Yeah, yeah. But when it hit my backyard, never, never had I felt more like a hypocrite, because I couldn't do what I said, what I was telling people. And I understand that today. That's a whole different ball. Oh, work your step. Yeah, here, work this step, you know? You know, but when it's your family and your loved one and they're dying and you're watching them, it's a different ball game, you know? And so I remember a few men on this program, and some of them are here today, man, told me, hey, Carlos, we got him, brother. You were there for us, we got him. And today's clean, man. He's got 11 years. Yeah, he's got a life. I got grandkids. You know, he's got a little business going. Man, he's just, when every time I look at him, man, you know, it's just amazing. You know, what this program, you know, I have two cousins / nephews. I'm so much older than them. They call me uncle. But they're clean, you know. I have so many friends. I've watched men here, man. You know, I've had the opportunity to watch men. And other people here, you know, get clean, man. And for me, that's a gift. That's why I stay, man. You know, that's why I stay, you know, because I like the man I've become today. I like the human being that this program, by working this program, that I've become. I don't ever want to be that other guy. And I can. Believe me, I've had friends. When you're around here 40-something years, you've watched men and women go out of here with 20, 30, 40 years. And it's a saddest thing in the world, man, because you know they're not going to survive out there, man, because they've been here too long. You know, Danny T talks about the seeds being planted. He's been telling me that for 40-something years. Hey, dude, the seeds planted. Even if you go, you're going to think about us, you know? You know, I remember one of the biggest gifts I got was when he told me, I went to him, 40-something years ago when I was, you know, when I was out there and I couldn't make it, man. And I remember I told him, I said, why do I keep getting loaded? Why does this happen? He said, dude, you're on the fence. You're in the worst place to be. Either have the balls to get in or have the balls to get out. One of the two, because the worst place you could do is you're going to die on that fence, you know. And I believe that today. I believe that if you're stuck in the middle, you know, I tell guys that today, and they go like, I remember somebody told me, why would you say that? Because it's true. Have the balls to get in, so maybe you have a chance of coming back, or have the balls to get out. So maybe you have a chance of staying, never having to leave again. You know, Me and my wife have been together for 39 years, you know? And yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what's in her that she married me, man. So I know her friend Cece. Her friend Cece's probably going, oh, don't let him remind you. No, but you know, I'm very thrilled. I'm very privileged to have her in my life, man. Because I'm not an easy guy, man. I'm not an easy guy to be married to. You know what I mean? I'm an idiot sometimes. You know, I try to work this program the best I can. I try to be the best human being I can. You know, but sometimes, you know, I fall short. You know, and anybody that says they don't fall short, I usually don't. I stay away from them because I usually believe that, you know, they're lying. There's no perfection here for me. I don't believe that anybody saves anybody in Narcotics Anonymous. I know there's people that run around are acting like they do, but I don't believe that any human being saves anybody. I believe we're a fellowship that hands one hand back, you know, to another hand in front, man, and that's it, period, you know. When I come to a meeting, whether I'm on a panel or whether I, you know, I'm here or whatever, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm just trying to touch somebody's heart, man, just like my heart was touched. You know, I believe that if I speak from my heart, that somebody's heart will touch somebody else's heart. You know, if I'm talking bullshit and just, you know, chucking and jiving, which I know how to do, you know, I'm just gonna chuck and jive, you know, somebody's gonna chuck and jive with me, you know? But I really believe that this program is about one addict helping another, period, you know? And that's what my primary purpose is. And the longer I stay around here and the longer I work it, you know, the better my life becomes, you know, the better our family becomes, you know, the better, you know, my relationship with my sponsees are, my relationship with my sponsor and the God of my understanding, you know. I believe today that God's been there for me, you know, ever since the day I dropped out, you know, I came into this world, man, you know, I haven't seeked him to lead me, you know, and today I do it my way, you know. Some people do it other ways, and that's their business, but I do it my way, you know, and he's led me down a good path, you know, he's given me a beautiful family, you know, and I couldn't ask for anything more. So why I stay is because Narcotics Anonymous saved my life, you know, and I owe Narcotics Anonymous everything. I can never repay Narcotics Anonymous again. Nothing I do could ever repay, you know? I'd have to be an idiot. My son has 11 years. He almost died out there, you know? My sister came here, and she didn't want no part of it. She was dealing with a dual diagnosis, and they carried her out in a bag, one of my sisters, you know? So I know how powerful this disease is, and I respect it, I fear it. But I also know how powerful this program is. You know, and this program is powerful. You know what I mean? And all of us together, not separation. I'm not really big. I mean, I'm from the San Fernando Valley area, but I come to the Narcotics Anonymous I came into back in the day in the 70s. It was like, Narcotics Anonymous, you're an addict. That's it. And everybody brings up, well, I'm on the west, east, north, and, you know, at the corner side, and I'm an addict, man. You know, I don't really give a shit where you're from. I really don't. An addict's an addict to me. But, you know, I'm like on the other side where the nicer area is. Oh, okay, yeah, okay. Well, good. When I go to your meeting, have some good cookies in, all right? You know what I mean? Don't have that cheap coffee like the county jail, you know? So, you know what I mean? I really believe in that. I believe an addict is an addict. And how long did you want me to go? Okay. So let me tell you about something that happened, man, you know? And so let me show you how important it is when people from different areas are connected in some form. And I saw this happen the other day, and I didn't even realize how it was happening. So, guy from San Fernando, a bunch of us are from the actual town of San Fernando. I don't know, we take pride in that. But with San Fernando, it's a little mission town, you know, about 15 miles from here, and a bunch of us are from there, and a couple guys here too. But anyway, one of the guys from that town, one of the older guys, well-known guy, you know, he has a family here. He moves to San Jose. He goes and gets clean. He goes over there, lives over there. He has a bunch of kids. Anyway, he ends up passing away, a great man, great guy. And he has a son in Texas. So they had lived in San Jose. That's where my wife's from, so I'm kind of familiar with San Jose. And, you know, so somebody's using, and they're in Texas, and they call somebody in San Jose, and through Zoom, I like to brag about Zoom, because I love Zoom. Through Zoom, a bunch of us, we have this meeting called Recovery in the Vario on Thursday nights. And a bunch of us from all over, and some of them are sitting here, we all get together, right? And we get to know each other, we get to like each other, and we become bonded through Zoom as brothers and sisters of Narcotics Anonymous. So through this, I meet a lady over there. She knows this family. I know the father. It's just this crazy thing. But anyway, she calls me, says, this kid, he's in Texas. They want to get him out here. So through a group of people, a circle, all the way from San Jose to here, to North Hollywood, the kid got in, and he's been in recovery for like two days now. He left and then went back. But that's through the recovery, man. That's through the circle. So if I bond myself to a corner, you know, I don't go to meetings over there, you know. Who the hell am I going to call if somebody, one of my cousins or something, you know? That's why I try to stay open, man, and I believe in it. I believe Narcotics Anonymous isn't about where you're from or what part, you know. Oh, I'm from this area. Oh, good. Great. You know, you can mop the floor. You probably, you know, whatever, you know. I mean, don't believe, I love San Fernando Valley, and I love the idea that I'm from where it started, and I love the idea, you know. But why I stay is because I have a beautiful life, you know, cut and dry. Why I stay is because, you know, I don't know who's coming in, who's going to be behind me, man. And I owe that to this program to be there. And, you know, because I might help you out. I might be in the meeting and help you out. And one of my family members might come out, come behind you, and you might be the one to help him out. But I can't ask you to help somebody. I can't ask you, hey, can you go help this guy? If I'm not willing to do it. If I want to take my 41 years and go sit at home and do nothing and not be active and not be inconvenienced or sacrificed, I can't ask you to do, hey, man, my little cousin's coming in. You think you might be able to hook him up, you know? I can't do that. And why should I? If I'm not willing to help yours, why would you be willing to help mine? I mean, even though Narcotics Anonymous don't look at it that way, but that's the way I see it, you know? I see it that, you know what, we carry the message equally, we give it, you know, and God, I believe that God, everybody that comes in my life, that God puts them in my life. Whoever, whatever newcomer comes into my life, God has put him there, period, you know? And if I'm not being out there and being willing to sacrifice to help somebody, then why should anybody help me, you know? So I know in this program and the people, you know, I have this sponsor, man. He's so awesome. He's so awesome. This man for over 50 years, he's been helping people. He's been doing things that nobody else will do. And he never comes to a mic and talks about it. Never. Never. He wants nothing in return. He's just a quiet man and he helps people. And that's the kind of guy I want to be. You know, I don't need to save nobody. I just need to be part of this fellowship and do my part. And I've watched this man. He never brags about it. Hey, I got this, I got that, or I sponsored it. He sponsors like, you know, 15, 20 guys, and nobody knows that, you know, and he's just a quiet man. My wife loves him because she knows what a good man he is. Most people that know him love him. Just not, he doesn't do anything off the chart, you know? He's not doing anything special. No ointment or no, you know, this or, you know, here, I got that for you. Nothing. He's just a man that carries the message, and he's there for people, and that's all he does. And that, to me, is a beautiful person. And that, to me, is what this program is about. You know, all the bullshit, all the, hey, 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 that's all cute, you know, but when it comes down to it, you took all that shit and a dollar, and you couldn't get a cup of coffee at Starbucks, you know. But when somebody's sharing their heart, man, and somebody's working from their heart, you know, I believe I'm just a vehicle. That's all I am. I'm not God. I'm no closer to God than any other human being that's helping somebody, you know? I believe that I do God's act, man. I do God's act when I do something and don't expect anything in return, you know? That's when I'm closest to God. Not when I'm up here talking about, not, you know, this, that. No, I'm closest when I'm doing the action. So when I see this man do what he does, you know, it's like, you know, when I'm around him, I just really feel God's presence, man, because I believe I'm with somebody that not doesn't talk about it. He does it, you know, and that's my gift today. I have a circle of people around me, you know, that do good, man. They're good men. You know, there's men here. You know, there's men here. I see plenty of people, man, that just carry this message, man. They carry this message, man, to the full.